Hello, everyone, and welcome to Heard on the Street, Street Fights podcast, where we uncover the stories behind the companies and, more importantly, the people that constitute this sector of media and advertising that we all call local. So where are they from? What makes them tick? What business and life lessons can we draw from that? So I'm Mike Boland, lead analyst at Street Fight, and our guest today is Walt Geer, who up until very recently was the creative director of Verve Mobile, and before that held several roles as a true innovator in digital advertising in terms of pioneering new formats and always pushing the limits, and that includes time at MTV and MySpace and several others we'll get into. So we talked to Walt from our studio in San Francisco about that journey and what he's learned from it and what we can all take away from that. But before we go into our episode, a quick reminder to listeners that Street Fight Summit is coming up quickly. It's already less than a month away. And as a bonus to listeners of this podcast, you can save 20% on registration by using the code PODCAST20. So we hope to see you there, and we hope you'll enjoy this episode. So here's our discussion with Walt Geer. So Walt, welcome to the program.
Hey, thanks so much for having me, Mike.
Totally. So we have a lot to talk about, including all the career milestones that I just mentioned. But before we do that, let's start with the present. So for those who don't know you, tell us a little bit about yourself.
Yeah, so I'm really see myself as a creative visionary who really tries to focus a lot on making concepts come to life, right? I love allowing for brands and consumers to connect in meaningful and memorable ways through transformative technology. And my passion really relies on, you know, the intersection between storytelling, design, technology, and most importantly, data.
Yeah, awesome. And I think that, you know, all of the things you've done so far certainly personify like everything you just said. So we'll go through some of those.
Thank you.
So what I want to do as we do on this show is kind of first go back in time and unpack the career path that got you to this point. So you've worn many hats and developed many skill sets that have really kind of come together to create, you know, a successful creative director. So let's unpack that a bit and start at the beginning. So where'd you start your career, and characterize that time in your life for us and, you know, the initial path that brought you into the world of digital media and advertising?
Yeah, so that's an interesting one. And truth be told, so it all started when I was young. So when I was young, I used to actually watch my father sit at his desk on his computer late nights in the dark with this small little lamp that used to be enough light to just illuminate his keyboard. And he'd always have Miles Davis playing on in the background. And I used to literally stand next to him and watch everything he was doing. So he used to be a computer engineer for Duracell and GE. And literally, as early as I could remember, when anyone would ask me what I want to be when I grow up, I would always say that I'd want to be an engineer. So I went to school for business management. When I got out, I had no idea what I wanted to do. My dad was like, you should get into this web design stuff. You could make a lot of money. And it was in 99 when, you know, .com was booming. I barely had an email address, and he got me an interview at Transworld. I went in, and to be 100% honest on this podcast of something I've never said to the world, but I lied about what I knew. I told them I knew HTML, JavaScript, and Photoshop. Got the job. I went and studied my behind off for 2 weeks and knew enough to manage and get through when I was there. A few jobs later, I ended up at the New York Times, which is where I really started focusing on advertising and building some of the formats in the market, expandable banners, things of that nature, the first surround session. And, you know, that was that. That's where it all really kind of began.
Yeah, very interesting. So then what happened? So kind of briefly walk us through the remaining career path from then till now. Like what got you to today? I know you were at MTV for a little while and MySpace. What's the kind of the quick timeline?
Yeah, so quickly, after I worked at the New York Times, I spent some time over at iBlaster, which is now Seismic. That's where I was really given the opportunity to work on, you know, Rich Media, one of the largest rich media companies in the world at that time. I spent a bulk of my time really developing ads and troubleshooting a lot of, you know, ad serving issues. I went on to DoubleClick, which is Google, and was a Rich Media project manager and engineer, where I did similar things. But where things really kind of took a turn and got really interesting for me is when I went to Viacom, at MTV. Mm-hmm. That was the first time where I was actually able to step away from doing some of the design and development a bit to actually strategizing and leading creative development and innovation, right? So the difference, though, was when I was there, I wanted to really take a different approach which is really kind of focusing on how can you be successful and garner, you know, higher amounts of engagement with consumers for brands by understanding things like, you know, why consumers engage, right? And we took more of a research approach while we were over there.
Mm-hmm. Now, DoubleClick is interesting. I didn't know that part about your resume. And that was, I'm not sure how close that was to the Google acquisition, but I think at the time that was the largest tech acquisition of all time. It was a few billion, which by today's standards in M&A activity is nothing. But were you there kind of pre-Google acquisition?
I was there, yes, pre and through the acquisition and afterwards, nice. For some time. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. So given that background, like as a creative director specifically, it's interesting, like you became a creative director later in that process. So tell us about the kind of, I like to think of it in any career like cross training. You do lots of little things, develop skills, and then they come together to be like a unique, you know, formula that creates the cocktail that is you and whatever that position is. So with respect to the creative director role, what are kind of the different skill sets that you picked up in all of those kind of places you just mentioned? Like, for example, you know, I know you have somewhat of a technical background, and you told us a little bit about some of that as, in an interesting way. Yeah. You also have 6 patents. So what are all the kind of ingredients in that cocktail?
Yeah, my background is pretty wide. I've run product strategy. I've been, like you said, a designer, front-end developer. I've run design and engineering teams. I've run innovation. I've been the guy who's out constantly, you know, pitching directly to the clients. Mm-hmm. I think that the role of the creative director today has changed drastically, right? So the days of, like, you know, the A-list Photoshop jockeys with master's degrees and whatnot has come to an end, right? The future of creative directors now turns on the intersection of, you know, marketing, technology, product design, sales, and data. Tomorrow's directors, and frankly today's as well, they have to sit at, like you're saying, at that crossroads of all these skill sets. You know, way back in the day, advertising appeared primarily on TV and, you know, print, and campaign results were evaluated based on, you know, longer game metrics such as revenue or coupon performance or quarterly sales. But now, you know, it's, you know, creative directors increasingly measure success off, you know, business, you know, by the numbers of users who interact with their work, right?
Yeah.
Campaign results like performance, swipes and clicks and time spent, et cetera, et cetera. So I've spent a lot of time really kind of focusing on a lot of different areas, which in some sense gets me in trouble when I go to interview and talk to companies because, you know, I fill a lot of roles that companies have. So it always ends up being like, okay, well, let's create something for you so you can help grow our business.
Right. And it's interesting, the public perception of creative directors seems to be like Don Draper in some cases.
Yeah.
Thanks to kind of fictional depictions. But also, interestingly, you know, you mentioned the technological aspect of the job is interesting, too. And it reminds me of the Gartner prediction a few years ago that by, I think it was like 2018 or 19, so we're about there, by that time frame, the CMO's tech budget, would actually supersede that of the CIO. And the thought being that MarTech and the amount of technology that goes into attribution, that goes into all those things you mentioned, is becoming so important that it's actually outweighing like the technology budget in the IT department in terms of just kind of like any organization's kind of internal tech needs.
That's true. It's very true. I mean, the role of the creative director, the role of the CMO, it all now involves like understanding data and technology. It's completely different than it was even 15 years ago.
Yeah. Now, speaking of kind of background, all the things that kind of create you as a professional, let's talk about some of the things kind of in your personal life. You're an avid sport biker. So tell us about that. And like, how did that start? You know, what does that do for you personally, professionally? You know, does it lend into kind of, you know, discipline, focus, and, you know, all that good stuff?
Yeah. Interestingly enough, it was my wife who got me into motorcycles.
Nice.
So she always wanted to get a motorcycle. She went and got her license. And, you know, I rode mopeds as a kid. And next thing you know, the both of us were walking in the store and walked out with motorcycles. A few friends of mine actually raced professionally, and they got us into actually doing it. And I got to say, racing has allowed me to think completely differently about my day-to-day job. And I never thought it would kind of put me in this position, but it's the truth. I see, when you're out there on a racetrack, you're riding 160 miles per hour down a straightaway. You're going 115 miles or 120 miles per hour through turns, literally with your knees scraping on the ground and other riders within inches of you, sometimes leaning on you. So I've learned that, you know, you there when you race, like, you have to focus within high stress environments
and quick decisions, right? Probably, right?
Quick decisions, right? Yeah. So that's in my day to day job. That's made me think, well, I need to make decisions quickly. And when you make a decision quickly, you need to stick with it and hope for the best outcome. But never, never hesitate.
Yeah. Interesting. When you first brought up your wife in terms of how that started, I thought you were going to say that you bought a motorcycle to impress a girl, being your wife. So that's great. Actually, we're going to pause here for a commercial break. And when we come back, more from Walt Gear. Hi everyone, it's Mike Boland here, lead analyst at Street Fight, and I want to tell you about the Street Fight Summit, Street Fight's flagship event, and it's coming up fast. So it's going to be June 5th and 6th, and we're going to be back in Brooklyn this year, and it'll have all the trappings of a Street Fight conference, including networking with top influencers in the local media and advertising community, lots of social events in and around the show, and of course a stellar program that's really coming together, including speakers from Google and Facebook and Microsoft and IBM Watson and several others. So you can find out more at streetfightmag.com. So we're back. My guest is Walt Gear. Before the break, we were talking about some of the things that Walt has been doing in his career, in his personal life, that kind of has shaped the professional, the marketing executive, and the creative director that he is today. So I want to drill down now into a few more things along that line, Walt. So you've taken lots of risks and shown lots of creativity when it comes to innovative new ad formats. And there are a few examples of that throughout your career. So tell us about a few of those. Particularly, we can start with what you did when you were at MTV with the Biometric Lab.
Sure. So, I mean, you talk about taking risks. That was all about not taking risks, right? So that kind of started because when we looked at the space, we're, you know, like everyone, we're all in this space trying to answer RFPs every single day. You get your 24 to 48 hour turnaround by some agency. And it's never enough time to really go back with something that you truly believe will be impactful for that brand. And a lot of the times, or at least back then, like 10, 11, 12 years ago, you could give any, you know, big grand idea. And as long as it was a takeover that was on a homepage of a site that got millions of views, then you could make $1 million easily for one day of that running.
Yeah.
Problem is, while a lot of those brands like Target and P&J and whatnot would spend that money, they want to know first, is it going to work? So our approach there was, we were thinking, well, how do we take the risk out? How do we come up with a big idea and guarantee that it's going to be successful? Thus, the Biometrics Lab. So but what a Biometrics Lab essentially is it allowed us to bring in individuals from different types of backgrounds, and we literally sat them down, and it looked like they were in an ICU. There's stuff on their head, there's stuff on their hands and their chest, etc. And we were able to understand the emotional state of a consumer or user when they engage with something. And in our case, it was ads. So we were able to do this by pulling things like heart rate, pupil dilation, arousal, which is sweat in the palms, eye tracking, mouse tracking, that time mouse tracking too, facial expressions. And it allowed us to understand what works in things based off color, calls to action, functionality, speed of animation. And then we were able to really create these big ideas, bring them into the lab, test them, know that they are going to actually work, and then go back out to an advertiser and bring them this format and guarantee effectiveness. That usability lab was the result of five of those patents, one of which was the very first skippable pre-roll, right? So I launched that, and I called it the fast forward pre-roll over there, and launched that 4 months before YouTube actually came out with their skippable pre-roll. Hmm.
Well, it's interesting too. What it reminds me of is I spend a lot of time studying emerging technologies like VR and AR, and one kind of subsegment of all of that is advertising in VR. And there are pros and cons. The cons is like the scale just isn't yet there to get any advertisers excited. But the pros are the ability to have a very engaged user, no ad avoidance, and the analytics, because you have such a immersive kind of experience, media experience, that those types of biometrics are very apparent. There is like very cute eye tracking. There's heart rate. There's all those things you mentioned. But the ability to kind of do that could kind of take a step forward. And actually, I hadn't thought about it, but it could be a place for some of your intellectual property there.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, indeed.
So let's talk about kind of more recently, but along that same thread of kind of pioneering different kind of ideas and concepts in digital advertising. So one thing you've become known for is the importance of creative in kind of the ad tech and specifically local advertising. Now, creative, of course, isn't something that's underrated more generally speaking. In fact, we were just talking about the Mad Men era where it was just kind of all about creative. But I think in the kind of location targeting ad world, we have seen a lot of the attention go to, you know, the actual geo-targeting, the geo-fencing, the targeting component of the campaign. But that has almost overshadowed something that's very important, which is the creative, when kind of brought together with that location targeting, can really have a good 1-2 punch and create better analytics. So tell us about that, the concepts behind it, and how you've kind of pioneered that line of thinking in the industry.
Oh, well, first of all, thank you for that. I appreciate your kind words. I've looked at this space, pretty quickly about 3 years ago, and realized that there was a massive issue. You see, what I've done throughout my career has really been that guy that's kind of stepped into a company, identify gaps, and then create solutions, right? And the first thing I saw was, oh my gosh, everyone in the space of location has the same exact stories. I was getting on stage, or I was getting on panel discussions with direct competitors from vast amounts of location companies, and they were all saying the same thing, right? Every single person thought that it was all about the right person in the right place in the right time. And I thought it was absolutely crazy, because even when I'm attending conferences, no one would talk about creative. But then when you'd go to any design conference, right, they would be talking about these high impact opportunities and innovation and how you do this format and that format and all these different ways to engage users with, you know, things on the mobile device. But the bigger problem is that they weren't talking about understanding the consumer. And under this, understanding the consumer meant you need to know the places they've been, the things that they do. Like, all of that is gives people the ability to target the right individual when it matters. So I came to the table and said, the conversation is wrong. What we need to be saying in this space is that you have to have both players in the same room. So my entire design and engineering team would sit in my last group job directly with the analytics team. And that was because we need to understand how the data works and how that could influence the creative. And they need to understand how the creative works and how we're trying to drive engagement from consumers. Mm-hmm. So what I've said in this space is that, you know, we need to come together, right? The creative folks and the data folks and the analytic folks, and we need to come together to actually truly create these opportunities under one roof. And that's because you will never get a user engaged if you're just targeting them, understand who they are, and you serve an IAB standard format that is static and stale, because we know that people don't look at some of these formats, right? Yeah. There's something called banner blindness. When I'm on my favorite apps or sites, I'll completely stop looking at these ads because I've seen them, I know where they sit, and I just completely tune them out. Now, when you're able to bring in more high-impact opportunities, stuff that the average person might believe is intrusive, if you understand who that individual is and you're able to deliver them this high-impact opportunity, knowing places they've been and knowing the things that they like, you in turn create an opportunity for these individuals that's an experience. Mm-hmm. And I think that's really, really important and critical.
Yeah, any type of mobile advertising. It's surprising that there isn't that cohesion to all of those like campaign elements already.
Right.
So moving on to kind of some of the environmental factors of the kind of the macro environment and the world we're living in, we're at an important inflection point in tech and business and the ad world when, you know, gender and ethnic diversity are getting more awareness. So you wrote a great op-ed in Media Post, and it was entitled Tackling the Black Quarterback Problem in Advertising. So tell us a little bit about the article and its takeaways.
Yeah, so that was a really interesting one. I wrote that article because I was actually in a situation where another black executive that I was introduced to by a white colleague was shocked when he met me and said, oh my gosh, like, you're a black creative director. This is the first time I've ever met a black creative director. After this conversation, my white colleague was floored to hear that this guy had said that to me and was like, wow, were you offended? That was a little weird. And like, and I thought like, it's nothing new to me. Right. So I've met about seven creative directors in this space that are black. Right. And I think that that's a problem, right? I've worked with two black developers in my entire career, and both of them were on my last team. So that article was written really to kind of just show the world my personal experience. But I think that we all talk a lot about inclusion and diversity, and now we're seeing so many diversity roles pop up at a lot of these larger companies. And I think that's great. But I think that we just need to do a better job of getting people of color and women in more senior leadership roles. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I myself felt that, you know, as a black professional, like sometimes we feel that we have to present ourselves in a manner that isn't threatening, or that, you know, there's this feeling of walking on thin ice. And, you know, I came up in my career and I, you know, think that, you know, this is the case for a lot of young professionals. But I also made sure that I absorbed as much as I could humanly take in, right? I studied the way my managers spoke, pitched, presented, and I learned from them. And truth be told, I didn't really know much about what a creative director was until probably, you know, when I got to Viacom, right? Like years ago. And you know, that changed a lot for me. So I think that it's important for, you know, people like myself to reach back and really kind of show, you know, the youth and kids in high school and college a little more about this space and the roles of creative directors, because I think that's where it starts. And then I also think that it really, you know, also starts with, you know, people in companies really kind of bringing on these type of talents, because there's so much talent out there that is untapped.
Yeah. Well, I also love your approach towards proposing solutions to this challenge that are more kind of organic, or tackling at its root through, as you said, mentorship and education, as opposed to things that I think a lot of people propose that are more of a patch, which are, you know, kind of job quotas or kind of backing into some sort of quota, as opposed to really making a difference in the ways that you're describing.
Totally, totally, totally. And that's one thing that I've definitely made a strong effort to do, really reaching out to different communities and reaching out and trying to mentor as many people as possible, and really kind of showing them how I got to where I am so they can take what I've done and help themselves.
Nice. So we're actually going to pause for another commercial break. When we come back, more from Walt Gear. Hi everyone, it's Mike Boland, lead analyst at Street Fight, and I'm here today to tell you about Artillery, which is a new publication and intelligence firm that's focused on VR and AR. Mobile AR, for example, has a large installed base of smartphones and real business models that are materializing around things like influencing local commerce. So we recommend that you go check out the site and its thought leadership of these key topics. And while you're there, you can sign up for the free Artillery Weekly newsletter. So head on over to artillery.co, that's Artillery without an E, and learn about some of the visually immersive technologies that could transform local commerce. So we're back. My guest is Walt Gear. Before the break, we were talking about a lot of the things that Walt is doing in his career and what's kind of led him up to this point. So, Walt, that brings us to the present. So you are currently at an inflection point professionally. So what's next for you? What types of opportunities are you looking for? This is actually kind of a rare opportunity on our show when we're talking to someone that is, you know, newly available between jobs. So in case there are any listeners that out there have potential synergies, you know, what are you looking for next? What's the next chapter look like for you?
It's a good question. I think that, you know, I've done a lot in my career. I've worked in ad tech. I've worked on, you know, the publisher side as well. And as cheesy as it might sound, like, I'm really looking to make a difference in the world, like, and truly impact people, right? So for me, that's really all about creating opportunities for brands to communicate directly with the people that matter. I love to innovate. I love to build. So at the end of the day, it is partnering with someone who's not afraid to break the rules, and partnering with people who are not afraid to really step out of their comfort zone and do things that are different and unique. I'd love to work with a major brand on some of that stuff. I'd also be really excited about working at creative agencies who just have exciting brands, right, to be a part of, and being able to kind of work across the spectrum with a lot of different people.
So that also brings up another kind of question I'll pile on top of that, which is, you know, throughout your career, you've probably worked for lots of different kind of types of companies in terms of headcount, in terms of culture. You know, do you prefer the kind of startup mentality? You mentioned brands in terms of working in-house. What are the types of environments that you think you thrive in most?
You know, that's a good question. I think that in a lot of the roles that I've been at, I've had the ability to work with some really smart bosses and people that mentored me and really showed me how to be better at presenting, pitching, and helping close things. And for me, that helped a great deal, because for creatives, like, at the end of the day, like, it doesn't matter how big your idea is or how great your idea is, it always involves, at the end of the day, really pitching someone, right? Pitching, whether that be your product team or your engineering team to get them to build this, whether that be a client, et cetera. Mm-hmm. I love working with people who are just a hell of a lot smarter than me, right? Yeah. Like, I don't want to be the smartest person in a room. So I'm really looking for the opportunity to sit in a room of really creatives and marketers who are just as excited as really making a difference as me, and people that are just, really inspiring.
Yeah, I think that's a key success factor. It's something that Mark Zuckerberg is fond of saying, is that, you know, success comes from surrounding yourself with people that are smarter than you. And I think when that doesn't happen is when you get kind of leaders that are either insecure or egomaniacs, and they have to have the big corner office and be the head honcho and, you know, kind of make sure that they don't surround themselves with smart people, whether it's out of fear or being threatened, or I'm not sure what. But it also reminds me of another great quote, and I forget where this initially comes from, but A people hire A people, B people hire C people. And A people hire A people because they are confident enough in their A-ness that they aren't threatened by other A's. They also, because they're A people, have a great A network and happen to be tapped into other A's. And then the B situation is also interesting, in that B people hire C people because, one, they have that maybe insecurity, they maybe don't have an eye for good talent, and then they don't have the network because they're in kind of the B crowd and the B network and the B Rolodex. But it's interesting. I think that, like, if you're an A and you're hiring A pluses, that takes a lot of guts and foresight and all that. And I think you're right on to that in terms of, you know, surrounding yourself with people that are smarter than you, because we always can grow more, right?
Yeah, that's really interesting, and I got to tell you, Mike, I'm gonna totally steal that. That's the first time
well,
I heard it.
I just stole it. So pay it forward. So let's move on to our lightning round. So we're gonna roll through a series of kind of quick hit questions to kind of end things off here. So Walt, what's something about you that few people know about? And you actually gave us a great one earlier about how you kind of got your way into that first interview. And we can go with that, or if you have another one, I'm happy to hear it.
That was going to be it, but I can make, I guess the next one on top of my head would be, I was a pool shark in college.
Nice.
So I used to play tournaments with friends, and we would go to other random pool or dorms to hustle people for beer money.
yeah, that's great. So I asked you the question about, you know, your sport biking and how that has developed professional skills. Did the pool sharking develop any professional skills?
Yes. How to hide your cards.
Ah, there you go. Nice. Absolutely. Well, it seemed like that kind of went along to help you get that first job.
Yeah.
So it worked.
Yeah, it did.
Second one. What is the profession you would want to have if you weren't doing what you're doing now?
That's the easy one. Musician. Nice. I love music. I just wish I was better at it.
Yep. That's great. Good one. What is the company or tech startup, and that could be one now that you admire or one throughout history, that you think it would be most exciting to be kind of part of at the beginning? Like, you know, the meeting of Jobs and Woz, or like the HP garage, or, you know, like anything like that. What's the company you would want to kind of be in the ground floor?
So that's a tough one. I cross between two, right? Yeah. One would be Tesla, because I think that they're just changing everything. We used to talk back in the day about, you know, one day we're going to be, you know, flying in cars. Mm-hmm. Now I can literally say with my 3.5-year-old daughter, I don't think she'll ever have to learn to drive in 13 years, right? So they're changing everything. But on the flip side, I would say Nike, because I think they just have done just an incredible job with their marketing and being there. When they signed Michael Jordan at the start of his, you know, his line of shoes, must have been just incredible to work with that as an iconic brand.
Yeah, well, and Phil Knight's just a genius marketing otherwise.
Gosh, yeah. Indeed.
So, what is your favorite tech product or app that you use as a consumer?
So You know what? I'm a huge Netflix fan.
Nice.
Right? So I think they have changed the TV experience completely. I mean, like, we used to sit around, like, I remember when, like, What was that Al Bundy show?
Oh, Married with Children.
Yeah. I could remember like waiting days to sit there, you know, to get to that show, and you'd get so excited and you'd watch it, and then you'd be kind of let down because then you have to wait again for another week. And now with like they've created binge TV, mm-hmm. right? Like binging, and you know, I'll sit for hours on some nights watching stuff, and you refuse to turn it off. And you know, they're just a major game changer.
Oh, absolutely. And now getting into a lot of original content, they're basically becoming.
Oh, yeah.
They're becoming HBO.
Oh yeah.
And their subscriber growth is off the charts, and their market cap just like passed some new milestone. I read about it yesterday. And also, I'll say I'm with you there because I'm a proud cord cutter since 2009.
Oh wow!
So I'm a big Netflix fan.
Really.
So who is someone from the business world, either alive or dead, that you admire most and why? We talked about Phil Knight and a few others, but...
Yeah, I mean, that would have been my go-to for sure. Can we call a government a business?
Go for it.
If so, to be honest with you, President Obama.
Nice.
Right? And so if you're listening, I'm available for breakfast, lunch, and dinner.
That's great. Well, that actually goes into the next question, which is who's a person... either alive, dead, or fictional, that you'd most want to like either have a drink with or breakfast, as you just mentioned, or lunch or whatever the case may be?
Jimi Hendrix.
Nice.
I think that he's just changed music. And you want to talk about pioneers and innovators? Mm-hmm. Like, he was the truest. I mean, the guy changed everything with how the sound of a guitar was produced. And I mean, incredible guy.
Yeah, besides creativity and, like, a new sound, he also remains, I believe, the, like, just technically and objectively the best guitarist that has lived to this date. And even if you look at, like, everyone else that has come since then, Eric Clapton, lots of blues guitarists, others, like... Hendrix is still the king.
By far.
What superhero power would you most want to have?
Persuasion.
Nice.
Persuasion indeed.
That I could see that would help in a lot in some of the kind of things that you have mentioned
indeed.
Your career so far. So what are some passions or hobbies that may help you mentally unplug from work? I think we already went over that with your sport biking, but I welcome any others.
Yeah, so one that kind of lets me get my creative juices going is actually flying my drone. So
nice.
I travel with my drone. It's a portable one. It's pretty small. I put it in my briefcase. I take it every place I go, every business trip I go. And instead of like the average person goes out and takes photos of things, I actually will get out like in the middle of the night or in the early mornings, wherever I am, and get it up in the air and shoot footage of different locations.
That's very cool. I'm actually an amateur photographer and have been for years, and I'm very into it. So I can appreciate that kind of hobby of getting out and capturing things. But of course, doing so in a different format. So I appreciate that. So lastly, what are some of your personal goals for the remainder of 2018?
It's funny. I just actually said it earlier. I'd love to just be at a major brand or a major creative agency, just with the ability to influence millions of people, really, and work on some engaging different ways to engage consumers. I think I just love this space. I'm really passionate about it. And, you know, I just would love that type of opportunity as moving forward.
Yeah, that's great. So I want to thank you, Walt, for spending time with us.
Thank you. I appreciate you having me here.
Yeah, this was fun. And thank you all for listening. And stay tuned for future episodes of Heard on the Street. You can find us on streetfightmag.com. You can subscribe on Apple Podcasts. And also stay tuned for lots more writings and multimedia from Street Fight. And don't forget that Street Fight Summit is coming up quickly. We'll be in Brooklyn again this year, June 5th and 6th. And the program is really coming together, including Google, Facebook, Microsoft, IBM Watson, and many others. And you can find out more on streetfightmag.com. So this has been Heard on the Street. I'm Mike Boland. Thanks for listening.